All right, gentlemen, welcome to Torah Studies. This is our weekly look at the Torah portion. Torah portion this week is Chukas, and Chukas has a most interesting opening mitzvah. And I will tell you that this mitzvah is not only fascinating as a theoretical exploration, it also holds incredible teaching and lessons for us all in how we can live our lives and build our relationship with Hashem. So, let's begin with the mitzvah. You can please open up your Chumash to 989. And the Torah portion, Chukas, begins with the mysterious mitzvah of the red heifer. Let's read it inside. We're going to analyze, discuss, schmooze a little bit about the laws, and get personal with the lessons. All right, so Marnin, if you don't mind, let's begin actually in the Chumash 989, opening of Chukas. Chapter 19, Book of Numbers. But then again, who's counting?
Okay. God spoke to Moshe and Aaron, saying, "This is the supra-rational command of the Torah, which God commanded, saying, tell the children of Israel they should bring you a perfectly red heifer, which is devoid of blemish and has never had a yoke placed on it. You should give it to Eleazar the priest. You should take it outside all three camps and a non-priest may slaughter it in his presence. Eleazar the priest should take some of its blood with his finger, turn so that he faces toward the front of the tent of meeting, and sprinkle it seven times. The cow should then be burned in his presence, its hide, its flesh, its blood, and its dung should be burned."
So far on this first page, we have a lot of animal violence, right? We're taking a red cow, and you are slaughtering it, and then you're basically burning this animal, the entire animal, hide, flesh, blood, dung, etc. The whole animal is burnt. Okay, continue. What do you do next?
"The priest should take a piece of cedar wood, hyssop, and crimson wool, and cast it into the burning calf."
Okay, so you have this cow that's burning, right? Not to be confused with the music festival Burning Man. Now you have Burning Cow. So you have the burning red heifer. You're throwing in your basic cedarwood, hyssop, crimson wool. And now you have this this very flammable mixture. Welcome. Okay, please continue. Yeah, 981 in the Chumash, verse number 7. You know what? Fast forward. We're going to skip a little bit. Skip two paragraphs. Go to the one that begins with the parentheses on 991, where it says the ashes are added.
"The ashes will be added to the sprinkling water, which is used for ritual purification."
So this is a key detail. So you take the animal, take the red heifer, you slaughter the animal, you burn the animal, you throw in the cedarwood, hyssop, and crimson wool into that burning cow situation, you take the ashes and you add them to the sprinkling water, and now you have a liquid that can be used for the purification rite. Please continue.
"Okay. The one who gathers the cow's ashes should immerse his clothes in a mikveh, and he will remain ritually impure until he dies. This is an everlasting law, both for the children of Israel and for the covenant who lives with them."
Okay, good. And then let's read three more verses, please. Page 91, 11, 12, and 13. Here, before you start, let me just mention that here the Torah tells us what we're going to do, what we do with the red heifer mixture. Again, we have the ashes, we have the water. What are you doing with it? Boom. Verse 11.
Anyone who touches the corpse of a human being will become ritually impure for 7 days. On the third and seventh days, he should ritually purify himself with the ashes of the red cow in order to become ritually pure. But if he does not sprinkle himself with it on the third and seventh days, he will not become ritually pure.
Continue.
Anyone who touches the corpse of a human being that died and does not ritually purify himself and then enters the temple courtyard has made God's tabernacle ritually impure, so his soul will be cut off from Israel.
Seems like a no-no.
That's pretty strong.
That seems like a no-no, right? If you're defiling my sanctuary, God says, that's it. You're out. All right. One more. Being
that the sprinkling water was not sprinkled on him, he remained ritually impure, and even if he immersed in the mikvah, his ritual impurity remains with him.
Right. Now, even if you go to a mikvah, if you are on this level of ritual impurity, coming in contact with a dead body, you can go from mikvah today to tomorrow. It's not going to help. You need the red heifer ashes mixture, called in Hebrew the para aduma. The red heifer.
So what do we do today?
Yeah. We're going to talk about that soon. We're kind of stuck. Okay. But let's first present an overall, a bigger question. And that is, what? What's going on here? You come in contact with death, so you become ritually impure. First of all, what does it mean to be ritually impure? Second of all, how does this red heifer mixture, ashes and water mixture, how does this help? And I want to explain something. We have to start with this.
Red heifer is pretty rare.
You know, they every so often you hear in the news, I guess, in certain news, you know, stations, or not stations, but like certain news sources, they say, oh, red heifer was found in Texas. You often hear this. There are groups, they're not necessarily Jewish groups, that are looking for red heifers because it's a thing. So like, wow, we found a red heifer. The red heifer has to have all red hair. I guess it's cows have hair, right? Whatever. It can't...
Coat,
whatever. Can't have... This is like a more formal term. Can't have even two black hairs. That would invalidate the red heifer. So here's the question. What does it mean to be ritually impure? And how does the red heifer help? And one thing I want to point out, in the very last verse... Hold on. No, it doesn't mention it here. Okay, here's the thing. Ritual purity and impurity does not have to do with cleanliness. When it comes to mikvah, a person has to be perfectly clean before they go into the mikvah. In other words, mikvah is not a physical cleanliness or uncleanliness, etc. It's a spiritual concept. So the first thing we have to do as we approach this topic and the questions that I asked, what does it mean to be impure, what does it mean to be pure, is that we're not talking about a physical phenomenon. It's not something that requires... It's not like you're physically unclean, so you need to become physically clean. You know what you need? You need the ashes of a burnt cow sprinkled upon you. Now you're clean. You're missing something. Like, you were almost clean. It's like I'm thinking of my kids now in Montreal. They're going to have bedside inspection. You know bedside inspection? So in camp, they have bedside inspection. You have to make sure the bunk is clean. They have to be all standing by their beds. They have to make their beds.
That was a nickel off the sheets.
So I don't know if it's to that extent. Your dad was in, where was he?
He was at West Point.
West Point. So that's more of a West Point thing. I don't know if camp gone Israel, Montreal is the same, but maybe. Anyway, I think Nassim told me that his bunk... Or one of the bunks, maybe his bunk. They at some point last year they had bedside every day because they needed to be like. Anyway, so here's the thing: it's not like, wait a second, this is unclean. Let's throw some extra, you know, ashes of a burnt cow on it and other stuff in it. That's not a thing. So clearly this is spiritual. So therefore it begs the question: what spiritually is going on? Okay, that's all the introduction. Now, let's discuss, before we jump into the red heifer details and the spiritual significance, let's discuss the general laws of purity and impurity. And these are topics that we've discussed before, but I want to frame it maybe a little bit differently than before. You know, today, when a person is keeping kosher, so there are a lot of things that you have to be mindful of when it comes to food. So you're thinking about, so when you're shopping in Publix across the street for kosher, so suddenly you're doing this. You're pulling stuff off the shelf and you're rotating. You're right, and it's not just the nutritional facts. You're looking for like the right symbols. And you're looking for other stuff. And then when you get home, you're making sure that the knife doesn't fall into the wrong sink. It's like, oi, that the plates are in the correct dishwasher, and that you're calculating, when was the last time I ate meat? When was the last time I ate dairy? And when I mix, right? There's certain things that you're mindful of as you keep kosher to make sure that, again, you're keeping kosher. So it's hard for us to kind of put ourselves in this place, but I mention this just to kind of paint a scenario. Back in the day, the times of the tabernacle in the desert and the times of the temple in Jerusalem, there was this issue of rich spiritual ritual impurity and purity. And you were mindful. It's this almost like this could have taken over your day. What am I about to sit on? Is the bed that I'm about to sit on? Is the chair? Is this, what's the status? Is it ritually pure or impure? You would want to know. You know those batteries where you can check the charge by pressing them? You should have like a purity, impurity thing. So you would be very mindful. The house that I'm walking into, is it a pure house, an impure house? How does it become pure or impure? Well, has anyone passed away in this house or in this building? Can I walk into this today? It would be a hospital. Can I not walk into the hospital? There are a lot of things that you would be mindful of. Has this fruit or vegetable that I'm holding in my hand, has it come into contact with water since it's been harvested? In other words, has any liquid fallen onto this fruit or vegetable since it's been cut off of the tree or pulled from the ground? Doesn't make it impure, but it makes it susceptible to impurity. So now the question is, if it's dry and it's from the ground, then it's not susceptible to impurity. But if it, at any point, not while it was growing, because then, you know, the rain is fine, but once it's pulled, you know the mist thing in the supermarket?
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
There you go. That doesn't make it impure. That makes it now susceptible to impurity. So people then were living with this constant, I'm not saying it's a burdensome thought, but it was a thought throughout the day, throughout their lives. What is the status? What is my status? What is your status? What is this status? Is it pure or impure? Today, we don't really have this on our minds, and we're going to speak about why in a moment. What was the problem with being impure back in the day when there was a temple? So the first thing we'll say is this. There is no prohibition about being in a state of impurity, ritual impurity. There is no mitzvah that says, thou shalt not be in a state of impurity. You can be in a state of impurity. So what's the problem then? You can't do certain things. We're going to read soon from Maimonides what it is, but I'll tell you outside and then we'll read it inside. Basically, the issues with being in a state of impurity, number one, you could not go to the temple. You could not go to the tabernacle. Number two, you could not partake of the sacrificial foods and other consecrated items. Let's take a look at this inside. Lolly, please read text number 2 in the handouts, Torah Studies books, page 222, Rambam. So let me explain what this is. So number one, if you were impure, you could not enter the sanctuary. That's number one. Number two, you could not eat sacrificial food. So if you brought an offering, sometimes you brought an animal offering, you were able to eat some of the animal yourself. You cooked it and you ate it. So you could not eat that if you were in a state of impurity. That's number two. Number three, the truma, which is the gift to the Kohen. You could not partake of that, I guess if you're a Kohen, if you're in a state of impurity. And also the second tithe. Second tithe means after you give the first tithe, 10%, to the Levite, to the Levi, then you took a second 10% for maybe 4 years out of the 7 year sabbatical cycle. You would take the second tithe, a second tithe, and you would eat it yourself in Jerusalem. You had to eat that second tithe in Jerusalem in a state of purity. Could not eat that in a state of impurity. Continue. And this is the key.
No prohibition at all partaking of eating ordinary foods. Partaking of ordinary foods while rather it is permitted to eat ordinary foods that are impure and partake of ordinary beverages that are impure. Indeed, the verse states the meat that will come in contact with any impurities should not be eaten. It can be inferred that while it is permissible to partake of ordinary foods while impure, because the verse is speaking only about sacrificial food.
So here's the deal. When does purity and impurity really make a difference? When you're dealing with sanctuary temple-related things, whether it's going into the space of the temple or sanctuary, or whether it is eating of the foods that are consecrated, that are associated with, again, these particular mitzvot. But otherwise, if you're just eating food casually, etc., it could be impure, you could be impure, it doesn't make a difference. Which is, as long as you're not in the temple. Now, this explains why today, for all intents and purposes, it's not a big deal if you're pure or impure. Why? Because we don't have a mikdash, we don't have a temple, notwithstanding the one in Peachtree, right? We don't have the holy temple in Jerusalem. So that's not an issue. So you're not going to go into a place that's holy because in a state of impurity, because that doesn't exist, number one. Number two, you're not eating of sacrificial foods because you're not bringing sacrifices. You're not eating truma because truma, the gift to the Kohen, is not brought. You're not eating the second tithe, Maaser Sheni, because, again, you're not bringing these tithes today because they're associated with temple times and being in Israel during temple times, etc. So, again, the way it stands today, us here, even in Israel, it really doesn't make a difference whether you're pure or impure. Doesn't alter anything. Doesn't change your day-to-day life. Yeah. Oh, we're going to get there. We're going to get there. That's the million-dollar question. Really, there's two questions. I start off with one question, which is, what does all this mean? But really, the personal question is, what does it mean to me today? If any way this is obsolete, and a Torah is timeless, which that's what we're positing, our approach is that anything in Torah is timeless. It has a lesson today for me right now. What's the lesson? Don't be impure. It doesn't matter. There's a lesson here. There's an incredible lesson here, which we're going to get to. Text number three, but first the build-up. Text three. Here's from the Ravid, a 12th century scholar, and he writes about the assumed status of all of us today. And again, this is written 800 years ago, 900 years ago, but this is still the assumed status of us today. Text number three, Karen. In other words, we are all assumed to be the highest level of impurity. Like this most severe level of impurity that would have required a red heifer, we're assumed to be in that status. Why? Because we haven't been careful otherwise. When was the last time you were like, wait, I don't want to walk into that cemetery, or I don't want to walk under that tree that's over, that's, think about it, back in the day, they couldn't walk under a tree that was halfway over a cemetery and halfway over the road. I remember growing up and hearing that on the Jackie Robinson, you guys know the Jackie Robinson Parkway in New York? Where there's a cemetery that goes alongside of it for a certain stretch, and there are some trees that go over, or maybe something else that goes over, and it's a question whether if you go under there, you're part of that impurity. It's like a legal question. Now, the only situation or the only individuals that all of this pertains to, ritual purity and impurity when it comes to coming in contact with dead, etc., is with regards to a Kohen. A Kohen is commanded not to come in contact with impurity. Steve.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
So does that mean if we're all in a state of impurity as if we have come in contact with a corpse?
Yes.
What if you come in contact with a corpse? What is the purification process? Nothing?
Oh, no, nothing. No, that's the point. The point is we're all on that level of impurity and there's nothing that we can do about it.
Okay, so in other words, there's no...
But for most of us, it doesn't make a difference. Why? Because again, it's not like we're being held back from going to the temple. There's no temple. And it's not like, oh, now you can't eat sacrificial food. What sacrificial food?
Yeah. Okay.
Right?
So, I mean,
so it doesn't affect...
At least as far as...
The lay person. Correct. Before we get to the priest in text 4, because we're going to see now that the priest is told, the Kohen is told in the Torah, that he has an extra degree of purity, and so therefore he should make sure, even if today... And again, Ravid says everyone is assumed to be that status. Nonetheless, you have to avoid coming in contact with death and impurity to the utmost, which has its own interesting laws associated with it. Text number 4.
And God said to Moses, "Speak to the priest, the son of Aaron, and say to them, let none of you defile himself for a dead person among his people."
So here we have an extra prohibition, an extra command that if you're a Kohen, you should not come in contact with a dead person. The Torah continues to say, with the exception of a father, a mother, a brother, a sister, relatives, close relatives, blood relatives, you can. But otherwise, a Kohen should not, which is why, traditionally, in traditional cemeteries, and I don't know if it's done, I'm sure it's still done today. The way they used to do it is they would bury the Kohanim who passed away by the edge of the cemetery so that other Kohanim who weren't like immediate relatives could come to the funeral but not step into the cemetery. Because a Kohen should really not step into a cemetery. There are real questions about a Kohen. You know, whatever. I mean, there's questions about coming at, can a Kohen be a doctor? With the assumption that at some point, a Kohen's going to come in contact with a dead body. Right? Unless you're a really good doctor. But otherwise, huh?
Unless you're a dermatologist. Well,
Raphael wouldn't go into my, I went to go visit my biological parents, or father Jim. Yeah, he wouldn't go in. I was cool with it.
Yeah, so you have this thing.
But he's also not supposed to be. No, sorry, I'm just rambling. I'm sorry.
No worries.
Keep going.
Yes.
The patriarchs and patriarchs that were buried.
Yes.
In order for people to pass in front.
Yes.
Of them.
I guess not if you're a Cohen.
Okay.
Yeah. Can you go for me? Right? It's like, hey, I need some. The idea is not to come in direct contact with a dead body and in the direct proximity of a cemetery. So I'll tell you this. So yesterday was the 3rd of Tammuz. What they do is, so you had tens of thousands of people visiting the Rebbe's gravesite in Queens, in Old Montefiore Cemetery. I was there Monday night. I waited for an hour and a half, went in for 3 minutes. So very special, and again, yesterday the line was 4 hour, massive line, literally tens of thousands of people from around the world came in for a very special day, the Yard Site of the Rebbe. So here's the thing, they build I should have mentioned this before, if you build a wall, and it doesn't have to be like a wall to the ceiling or whatever, as long as it's 10 tefachim, which is about 3 feet, if it's 3 feet off the ground, that constitutes a halachic, Jewish legal barrier between this domain and that domain. So they create a pathway into the cemetery, into the ohel, and it's got walls up. They actually have higher walls because they have lines. It's like one of those things. Yeah, it's like a queue straight up. And but even otherwise, they always have a path. They have a path that has know that green...
Not part of the cemetery.
So that blocks it off. So if you walk down the path, there's no one buried in the path, right? So they created a path. And generally, like cemeteries have paths, but they cleared a path and they put up these things, these like lowish walls that are halakhically, legally the right height. And that's it. So you're not in the cemetery, you're in the path, and it's kosher. So a kohen can go. Once you're by the ohel, which is the Rebbe's burial spot, then it's fine. It's not considered to be... We'll have another class on that, why that's okay. But a kohen is allowed to go in to the graveside of a tzaddik. It doesn't have the same status. Okay, so that is that. Okay, so here you have a basic idea of the way it was then. What did ritual purity and impurity affect? Where you could go, what you could eat. Today, what our status is, and the fact that there's really nothing to do about it. There's nothing that can be done about ritual impurity today. And we just try to avoid that issue. Now, in addition to the death ritual impurity that's incurred by coming in contact with death, there are other forms of ritual impurity. There are other forms of ritual impurity that mikveh does help for, but that's another topic. Now, let's talk about some of the rationale behind ritual impurity. As I mentioned before, it seems like a very strange thing. What does it mean to be ritually impure? Why is it, what's actually going on? And here we have a teaching from the Sefer HaChinuch, which is a very interesting book that explains all of the 613 laws of the Torah. It gives like a philosophical, psychological explanation. Here we have Rabbi Aaron Halevi of Barcelona, who gives an explanation about ritual impurity and the damage that it causes. 225, Amy. And by the way, it only works in the Hebrew. The Hebrew says, "V'lo sitamu bahem v'nitmeisem bam." Don't become, how's it translated here? You shall not defile yourselves with them to become unclean through them. So it says, you shall not defile and then to become unclean. So our sages say in the Talmud, the second word, the second phrase of unclean, to become unclean, which is vinitmesem, can be read as vinitamtam. Not vinitmetam, but vinitamtam, which means stuffed up, clogged up. So what he's saying is, what does it mean to become ritually impure? It means that it's almost like there's a blockage in the intellect. You know, it's like medically when the arteries, God forbid, get clogged. This is like bad cholesterol for the intellectual soul, according to the Chinuch. Becoming ritually impure impairs the intellectual soul. Okay, continue.
For this reason, in a place that is holy and pure and where God's Spirit is present, it is not befitting for a person sullied with impurity to stand. This can be likened to a royal palace from which any leper or any person whose body or clothing are dirty must be banned. As the verse states, for one may not enter the king's gate dressed in sackcloth.
And I think I'm pretty sure that is from the book of Esther, where remember she's fasting, and Mordechai's fasting. Remember that they were fasting because of the decree, and she said, I can't go in dressed in sackcloth. No one is allowed to go in dressed like this, so I have to get dressed up in royal garments.
Was it a Mordechai that was dressed?
He was, but I think she also...
She
also fasted. She definitely fasted. Fast of Esther. For sure she fasted. I'm not sure. Because he didn't go... Definitely Mordechai dressed, but he didn't go into the palace.
Oh, right.
She's the one that went in. I don't know. I'm not sure. I have to look it up. Anyway, either way, the point is that you don't enter a royal palace in a way that's unbefitting. So the Chinuch says, when you're impure, it's not just a very ethereal thing. It means that there's also something, there's an impairing of the intellectual soul. That's what he says. And so therefore you need to become pure. Does this help?
No.
Why not? I agree with you. Why not?
Well, because it...
Does this help us understand this idea of purity and impurity in red heifer? I'm saying no.
Yeah.
I hope you agree with me. Good, exactly. Why? So I touch a dead body. So now my intellect is impaired. What's the connection? He says, in your state of ritual impurity, the intellectual soul is stuffed up, it's impaired, and you're unbefitting to step into unholy ground. Why? What happened? I touched a dead body, and so I can't think anymore, I can't understand things. My wisdom doesn't work as it should. And how does the ash of a red heifer reverse that condition? Right. Tell me to eat less cholesterol and whatever. I get it. Cholesterol, no good. Less, more, whatever it is, right? I'm not a doctor. But right, more, no good, less good. We get that. But you tell me that dead body, impairing wisdom. Ashes of red heifer, healing wisdom. Come on. That's not giving us a rationale. That's giving us something, but that's not really breaking it down. And why in the third and seventh day? Because you got to get it on those days. That's when the intellect is really, what is that? Right? You have to sprinkle it on the third and seventh day, and then the person is purified. In other words, even after the explanations, there are many details of this mitzvah. Our mitzvah, the Torah portion that we're studying this week, the opening mitzvah of the Torah portion, there are many details of this mitzvah that don't have a rational explanation. And the truth is, and this is where we're going with this, the truth is this mitzvah does not have a rationale. In fact, there are three names for mitzvot, for the commandments. There are Eidos, Chukim, and Mishpatim. I'm going to start from the last one, Mishpatim. Mishpatim are those mitzvot that make sense. The logical, rational mitzvot. The laws. The laws that make sense. In other words, stealing is wrong, and murder is not okay, and charity is good. These are laws. These are biblical commands, all of them. And they also make sense. These are mishpatim. And then you have eidos. Eidos are those mitzvos. Eidos, eid, is a witness. Eidos are testimonials. We use here a company called All Good, Pest Solutions. You guys know All Good? They have testimonials. Did we speak about this recently? I feel like we did. No, we didn't. They have testimonials. Yeah, my house was overrun by the bugs, and then I got... It's hilarious. It's spoofy, and it's brilliant. It's brilliant marketing. Anyway, so, right? Testimonial mitzvot. What are those? Testimonial mitzvot. Those are the mitzvot that bear testimony to something that happened in our collective national history. For example, Passover. Passover, exactly. Passover, the Seder, the Matzah. You have the Shofar in Rosh Hashanah, the fasting in Yom Kippur. These are not rational mitzvot in the sense that if you didn't have a Torah, you would have come up with them anyway. You wouldn't have, necessarily. But now that you have, you've been given this mitzvah, it makes sense. Every nation has celebrations, has rituals that they do to commemorate their unique history. In America, we have 4th of July. We have Columbus Day. I love Columbus Day. I'm a huge fan. There's nothing like a day that celebrates when somebody found someone else's place. And he's like, hey, I just discovered it. And they're like, no, you didn't. We've been living here. It's like, no. And you guys are Indians. You're like, no, this is not India. Doesn't matter. This is it. It's Columbus Day. Right? It's unbelievable. Anyway. What a guy, right? Anyway, so here's the deal. So every nation has its eidos, its testimonials, its rituals, its celebrations that commemorate something that happened in the past of significance. So the logical mitzvot, the mishpatim, the eidos, the testimonials, they all make sense in their own way. Then you have the chukim. The chukim are the decrees. Those make no sense. Those are like, don't wear a garment mixed of wool and linen. Why? Is this like a fashion violation? No. God doesn't want it. God's like, who are you wearing? Wool and linen. No, maybe it's stop. God says no wool and linen. That's it. Done. Milk and meat. No milk and meat together. Why? Go figure. These animals are kosher, and these animals are not kosher. It's got to chew its cud and have split hooves. Why? Kosher fish, fins and scales. Why? These are all chukim, these are all decrees. All of the laws of ritual purity and impurity are chukim. How do I know they're chukim? The chukim, i.e. decrees, that are not rational. They don't have a reason for it. They're just God's decrees. How do I know that it's a chok, that it's a decree? What's the name of the Torah portion? Chukas. Zot chukat ha-Torah, the Torah portion begins. This is the chok. Is singular for chukim. This is the decree of the Torah. There are many decrees of the Torah, super rational or not rational decrees of the Torah, but this is the ultimate. This one defies all logic. This one, with the ritual impurity and then the purification, with the, you take an animal, so you came in contact with a dead body, no good. So how are you going to get pure? We're going to throw ashes of a dead cow at you, and that's going to get you out of that. How'd that work? If the problem was death, why are you throwing more death at me? Don't worry. Don't question the system. It works, right? This is it. It's a chok. It's irrational. It's, I don't say irrational. It's super rational. I got a patent on it. Let's take a look at Maimonides. Maimonides says this clearly, that this is a super rational decree. And I want to call you Amy's dad, but I don't know your name. Your first name?
Steve.
Yeah. Are you up to reading text number 6?
Amy's dad works too.
All right. Awesome. Text 6.
It is clear that the laws of ritual impurity and purity are divine decrees and cannot be evaluated by human intellect. They are in the category of chukim. Likewise, the laws of immersion are in the category of chukim, for ritual impurity is not mud or waste that can be washed away with water. Rather, it is a divine decree that once a person immerses, he or she becomes pure, even though nothing has changed the body.
I love how Maimonides puts it. He says, you're not washing away mud or dirt. Do not think that immersing in a mikveh, he's not necessarily talking about this red heifer. He's talking about, in general, the laws of purity and impurity are not rational. Are not. He says, it's not a health cleanliness issue. You'll have people that say, that why did the Jews not... Why were Jews not affected by the plagues of the past when they had these big plagues? And they said the Jews did it because they weren't dying. Ah, it's because the hand washing or the mikveh. It's not the mikveh. It's not the hand wash. Well, maybe it is. But okay, but that's not why. That's not why we got the mitzvah. That might be a benefit, right? But that's not why we have it. A mikveh, as I said before, is supposed to go to the mikveh only after you're perfectly clean anyway. So if you're clean, why are you going into the mikveh? If it's all about cleanliness, you were clean before. What are you getting to the mikveh for? It's not about that. He says, once a person immerses, he or she becomes pure. This last line is powerful. Even though nothing has changed in the body. Nothing has changed, and yet everything's changed. How? Why? Oh, it's a decree. Well, how does that work? That's the point. You don't understand how it works. That's why it's a decree. If it made sense, it wouldn't be a chok. It would be a mishpatim, an edus. It would be a different category. Take a look at the Midrash. The Midrash elaborates on this as well. Mike, text number 7.
This is the decree. As the verse states, who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean one? Not one. God, however, can bring a clean thing out of an unclean one, such as Abraham, who came forth from Terach, Hezekiah, who came from Ahaz, Yoshia, who came from Ammon, Mordechai, who came from Shimi, the Jewish nation who descended from idolaters, the world to come, which comes from this world. Who did this? Who commanded this? Who decreed this? Was it not the one above?
So basically, the Medrash is basically saying that everything associated with purity and impurity, it's all a paradox. It's all a contradiction. It doesn't make sense. It's like you get clean from a state of pure from a state of impurity. How does that happen? Only God decrees it, so therefore it works. Continue.
We have learned a becheret, a form of leprous tuma, the size of a gris, makes a person impure. but if it grows to cover the entire body, he is pure. Who did this? Who commanded this? Who decreed this? Who is not the one above?
Was it not the one above?
Was it not the one above? We have learned if an unborn child dies within the mother's womb and the midwife touches the fetus with her hand, the midwife is impure for 7 days, but the mother is pure until the fetus leaves the womb. Who did this? Who commanded this? Who decreed this? Was it not the one above? We have learned if a person dies in a house, the house is pure. Once the body exits the house becomes impure. Who did this? Who commanded this? Who decreed this? Was it not the one above? We have learned the clothes of one who handled the para aduma from beginning to end are impure, but the para aduma itself purifies clothing. God said, a statute I have set, a decree I have decreed, and you are not permitted to transgress my decree.
And that last line basically sums it up. In other words, what the Midrash is saying here, by Midbar Rabbah, this text is basically saying that when it comes to the laws of purity and impurity, the whole thing is a contradiction. You have a small leprous sign, then you're impure. But if it's the whole body, then you're pure. It's not rational. The point is, all of this is not rational. It's divine decree. So trying to figure out is a little bit of a wild goose chase, because you're not going to be able to figure it out. Text 8 is another Talmudic, or is a Talmudic... it's coming from the same Midrash. Is another account, this one with the great rabbi Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, that also speaks to this same theme. I'll read this one. A certain Gentile asked Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, these things you do seem like witchcraft. You take a bull, burn it, grind it, and take its ashes, and then sprinkle 2 or 3 drops of it on an impure person, and you say, you are pure. So he's saying, what is this Jewish religion? You guys are like all witchcrafty. So the rabbi answered, have you ever been possessed by a spirit? No. Have you ever seen such a possessed person? Yes. And what do you do to such a person? So he answered, you take some roots, smoke them beneath him, sprinkle water upon him, and the spirit departs. Rabbi Yochanan and Zachary replied, let your ears hear what you just said. So it is with the spirit of impurity. We sprinkle upon it, and it departs. So he answers this fellow by saying, what do you mean? How do you do an exorcism by you guys? The same thing. You do some sprinkling, you ta-da-da, and the spirit's gone. We do the same thing. So what's the question about Judaism? After this Gentile left, his students asked, Master, this Gentile you brushed aside with a stick, in other words, with an incomplete answer, so he'd be satisfied. But to us, what is your answer to the Gentile's question? In other words, you brushed him off, you got rid of him by saying, yeah, whatever, you do the same thing. But what's really the answer? Why are we sprinkling the ashes from a red heifer on somebody to purify them? He replied, by your lives. In other words, I don't know exactly, but you should know, the corpse does not defile and the waters don't purify. Rather, God said, a statute I have set, a decree I have decreed, and you are not permitted to transgress my decree as it is written. This is the statute of the Torah. In other words, the message is, again, that it's super rational, it's not something that's logical, etc. Now here's the $1 million question, and this is Marnine's question. Congratulations, you just won the $1 million. Or at least you preempted the $1 million question. And that is, fine, so we get it. As much as we're going to try to figure this out, we're really not going to understand it. So one thing we know, it's not a logical thing. It's super logical. It transcends rationale. Got it. What does it have to do with me? On two levels. Number one, if it's super rational, so then I can't understand it anyway. So why? Might as well, like, so what are we doing? Number one. Number two, this whole mitzvah doesn't pertain to us today anyway. Because there's nothing, we're all assumed to be the status of ritually impure, coming in contact with death, and we don't have a red heifer. So then, on two levels, this mitzvah does not seem to have a message for us. Number one, it's not logical, so what's the message? Number two, it's not applicable today, so what's the message? Now, we can't leave it like this, because Torah, the word Torah means instruction. It's a life manual. You always wonder, you know, people say, how come life, when you have a child, they don't come with an instruction manual? We do have an instruction manual. It's the Torah. Okay, maybe there's lousy marketing, but that's our fault. We have a life manual. The problem is, you open up the manual, you know, sometimes you buy something, you know, maybe on eBay, or maybe on like a foreign website, and you get it, and it has like the weird translation. You know what I'm talking about? Like, it was done in China, it's like made in China, and it's got the English that doesn't really make much sense. Yeah, it's like, right, Google Translate, it makes no sense. Like, wait, that's not even a thing. You just wrote a paragraph here that doesn't even say anything.
It's like the emails I'm getting from Hebrew University that are in Hebrew and you push a button.
Oh, translate. Yeah. And it's like, no. And it's like, no, that doesn't make any sense at all. Right. Exactly. You do that, you get the Hebrew. Why don't they write it in English also?
What's that?
Why don't they write them in English also?
Because it's coming from like dormitory management.
Okay.
You know, like it's
dormitory, I can imagine, that would be funny. A dormitory management email translated, yeah.
Offices, you know, not from the actual school or department.
Right.
It's coming from the offices, and so like they send it and they have it translate.
See, here's the problem. We're reading about red heifers and purity and impurity, and we're saying to ourselves, what are you hacking at, Chinik? What does this mean? What does that do with me? Can't do it anyway today, and it doesn't seem relevant. So we skip it, or we say, forget about it. It's not relevant. Do we realize that life issues can be healed, can be helped, can be solved with the red heifer, with the message of the red heifer? I think I just asked the question. I'm not sure who's supposed to answer that. But we should realize, we should realize that this has incredible wisdom. And now let us begin to unpack the secret message, the deeper message of the red heifer. Here we go. When we have the three categories of mitzvot, you might think that the ideal is that even the mitzvot that we don't understand, the chukim, we should do them with the same passion as the mitzvot that we do understand. In other words, you appreciate the value of giving charity, of volunteering in a soup kitchen because you know you're helping somebody out. You should have the same passion for kosher, for wool and linen, for Shabbat, for whatever. Shabbat's probably not a chok, not a rational decree, whatever. But many would think that what's the message or what's the framework? How does it work? Do the chok like you do the mishpat. Do the chukim like you do the mishpatim. Do the super rational decrees as you do the rational things that make sense. But the truth is, it's the opposite. The message is to do the mishpatim like you do the chukim. And I'll explain. The chukim you keep for one reason and one reason only. And that's because I was asked to do this. You have no idea why you were asked. You have no idea what it does. You were told, you were asked, please do me a favor, push that button. Why? What does it do? Why do you want me to do it? Please, push the button. But why? You're getting like all agitated. But wait, tell me why. There's no why. I just would like you to push the button. Will you push the button? If you push the button, what that means is you are completely connected to the will, to the desire of the one asking you to push the button. When you have this sense of value in pushing the button, when you understand why you're doing it, when I push the button, good things happen, then why are you pushing the button? Because it makes sense to you. What's the problem then? It sounds good, right? Well, what happens if it doesn't make sense? Then you're less likely to push the button. In other words, if you train yourself to do the things that make sense or to only do the things that make sense, the moment you encounter resistance, something that doesn't make sense, what happens then is that you drop it. And that's sometimes very unhealthy. I'll give you an example. Marriage. In marriage, if a spouse only does the things for the other that make sense to them, that's going to be a challenge, right? It's like, wait a second, that doesn't make sense to me. And if it doesn't make sense to me, that doesn't make sense. And therefore, you shouldn't want it and I shouldn't do it. Let's see how far that goes, right? That's not a recipe for success. A relationship requires exercising this muscle, which is to be open, as I wrote in the email, I wrote it late because I flew today, to be able to surrender to another. Surrender. It may sound like surrender, scary. I don't want to surrender. It doesn't sound like a good thing. But any healthy relationship requires surrender. Parenting requires surrender. Your child doesn't want to go to sleep. You want your child to go to sleep. Not speaking from personal experience at all, right? Not at all. Right? Your child doesn't want to go to sleep, or your child can't sleep. And all you want is for your child to sleep. It requires surrender. Surrender the ability to say, it's not about me. It's about the other. It's about what they need. It's not about what I need. And it's not about whether or not what they need makes sense. If I question what someone dear to me wants every time they say what they want, again, that's not a healthy recipe. That's not a recipe for a healthy relationship. So the message is like this, and this is something that Hasidic philosophy puts a very strong emphasis on. The message of the chukim, of the super rational decrees of the Torah, is God says, if I only gave you mitzvot that made sense, I would be harming the human. I would be messing you up as a human being. I would be destroying you. If I only gave you things that made sense, I would be harming you. Because I would be training you to only do the things that make sense. And you would never have the ability to transcend yourself. You would be stuck in your own rationale. Stuck, not only material, I mean, that's a lot. You'd be stuck in your own head. You'd be stuck in your own box. You wouldn't have the ability to see anywhere outside of what you know or what you think or what you believe. You wouldn't have the ability to suspend yourself and see something else. The greatest achievements, I mean, even modern achievements in design and technology, have only occurred because somebody was daring enough to see beyond what was known. Somebody dared enough to ask the question, well, what could be if? That muscle is only exercised when you have the ability to look beyond what you know and what you think and what you believe, to look to the unknown. So it's the chukim. It's these super rational decrees. And by the way, you don't have a muscle until you exercise it. I mean, you have the muscle, but the muscle is not strong until it's exercised. So this the idea of the chukim, of the super rational mitzvot, these exercise our ability to go beyond what we know and what we believe that we know and what we're comfortable knowing. So God says like this, I'm going to tell you something about impurity. And then I'm going to tell you something about purity. And you're not going to understand it. And that's by design. And you're going to push against your logic. You're going to push against your mind. And your mind's going to tell you, this is ridiculous. Your mind's going to tell you, this is a waste of time. If you give into that, you're going to be a slave to your own brain. And if you're stuck in your head, that's a very dangerous place. If you're stuck in your head, not only does that hamper personal achievement, but that also, again, going back to my original application, that also serves to hamper one's ability to have a relationship with somebody outside of themselves. This idea of being stuck in what I know and how I see things and how I understand things is very detrimental to the human being themselves. So Torah, our life manual says, God says in Torah, I'm giving you things that you will not understand. Do them anyway. I ask you to do them anyway for your own benefit and for God's benefit. We don't know why God wants it. We don't know why God gave it to us. God has a reason, or He doesn't have a reason. The truth is, as we'll see in some of the texts, we'll do another few minutes. There are two elements to every mitzvah. There's an element of rationale and reason, and there's an element of will and desire. Like anything in life, somebody asks you to do something. Can you go to the store and get me the newspaper? So there's a reason that's implied. I want to read the paper. But there's also the sense of, this is what I want. Are you ready to do what I want? And sometimes, again, going back to human relationships, it's the want that is more important than the logical reason behind the want. A lot of times conflict, and we have this conflict resolution seminar coming up, a lot of time conflict comes up because one of the parties, or maybe both parties in a relationship, feel disrespected and not, like the other is not attuned to their needs. And a lot of times that happens from small things, little things. Like I asked you to take out the garbage. I asked you to come home on time. I asked you to do this, and you didn't do it. It's not about, But wait, why did you want me to take out the garbage? Because of this, that? The other could give a rational explanation why they didn't do it. That doesn't help. Because what the other, what the party that's feeling, the frustrated party, what they feel is that you, right, the other party, is just doesn't care about what they want. It's not about the logic. You see what I'm saying? It's like, I want the newspaper because I want to read the news. So you tell them, no, I'm not going to, I don't want to get you the newspaper. Yeah, here's my phone. Read the news. Take out the garbage. Nah, I'll take it out tomorrow. Come home on time. Yeah, I have a good reason not to be home on time. I don't want an explanation. Right? I want you to appreciate that I want something and you're ready to do. I want to feel like I'm in a relationship with someone who respects what I want. Again, there's two things in every mitzvah, getting back to divine commands. In every mitzvah, there's two elements. There's the rationale behind it, and then there's the ratzon, the will, the desire behind it. One has a ration, one has an explanation, and one doesn't. Some mitzvot have seem like more heavy on the explanation, some more heavy on the will. The bottom line is every mitzvah has a little bit of both. And when it comes to the chukim, when it comes to these super rational mitzvot, what we sense right away is the will, the desire part. Let's quickly, you have a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, is surrender the same as emunah? I mean, is it different?
Surrender is, I'm ready to do what I'm asked to do without getting in the way, without me getting in the way. That's one definition of surrender in this context. That's what I mean in this context.
I was thinking that you were saying it's really surrendering your animal soul, because there's a part of us that we don't really know, like our spiritual self. And if we try to logically understand it, it's limited. And it's unlimited. And so therefore you have to surrender over the situation, because that limits you to the known, and there's something that's beyond
what is known.
What is known.
That's what I was thinking of, you know, if it had any correlation to trust and faith.
It's all faith. You see, without faith, then your question is, who says this is what God wants?
Right. Okay.
I mean, just basic faith in God, Torah, Mitzvot, etc. You're like, who says God wants this? This is just, you know, Bubba Mises. So there is obviously a foundational faith.
You don't even say God, you say Hashem.
Hashem, the name.
Because there's not even, because then when you say God, you limit.
Right, you're defining it. In other words, this is, the faith would be the foundation. The faith is that this is what God wants. The faith is that God recorded, that this is in the book. This is what God wants. This is what God wants us to do. And even if we don't know why, it's not even if we don't know why. When we don't know why and we still do it, it brings the best out of us. And it's a model in which we can perform all the mitzvot. In other words, when we do a mitzvah that makes sense, we give charity to someone that's hungry, we give them some food to eat, we can do with the same dedication and devotion, the same surrender as we would with the red heifer. In other words, yes, it feels good. Yes, I feel like I made a difference, but it's not about me. It's not a self-serving experience. This is for a cause. I'm surrendering to a cause that's greater than myself. That's beautiful. Somebody who says, hey, look at me. I just volunteered at a soup kitchen. Hashtag, I'm awesome on Instagram. That feels a little bit wrong. Now, it's right, but it feels a little bit wrong. Why? Because that's a lousy hashtag. No, I'm kidding. Also because it turned out to be a self-serving experience. We respect those that are ready to be present in the moment and be giving of oneself, of themselves, because that's what the situation called for. That's what a chok is. A chok, as opposed to a mishpat, is I'm not doing this because of me, because of ego, because of my brain, because of my wisdom, because of myself. I'm doing this because this is what I'm being called to do. It's a calling. And that's a powerful thing. And in this sense, I want to end with this idea. In this sense, what this tells us is that every mitzvah touches on this same pure, essential desire of God. Sometimes you say, look, there are big mitzvot and small mitzvot. So like, I don't know, matzah on Passover and shofar and Rosh Hashanah, and the certain mitzvot are big or feel big and certain ones feel small. Where's the big and where's the small? It's all in the head. We're the ones that decide based on our rationale, this one feels, or we understand this one to be important and this one not so important. That's a rational thing. When it comes to God, now here's the thing. There may be bigger and smaller mitzvot on one level. Remember I said every mitzvah has the rationale behind it and has, like, get the newspaper. Okay, take out the garbage. Pick up the kids from school, right? I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, pick up the kids from school, honey, is bigger than take out the garbage. I'm going to say that, okay? Because, you know, otherwise kids are stuck at school. You know, like, where's my parents? So kids at school, pick the kids up from school, take out the garbage, so you can logically say, okay, this one's more important. Here's the deal. They're equal. So on one level, they're different. On another level, they're the same because they both represent what the other wants. They want the garbage out. They want the kids picked up. And to not be sensitive, to not be aware of the desire that's at the core of the ask, is to really miss the essence of it. There is a logical that you can rank. It's like, you know, college football. You can rank it. You know, this. You can rank the needs. But at its core, it's a need. It's a want. And all wants are, the way Kabbalah says, all wants are indivisible. It's a pure want. One want is not greater or less than another want. They're all equally wants. Rationale, there are distinctions. But when it comes to want, desire, they're all the same on that level. Which is why, again, a lot of conflict and tension in a relationship can come from the small things that are neglected. But I didn't neglect any big things. Wait, but the small things mean that you don't care about me. But they were small. Not to me. And even if you can logically explain why they're not small, but I wanted it. Don't tell me that it's small. I wanted it. And want is big. So now we're touching on the final point. Every mitzvah is God's will. And therefore, every mitzvah is very important and equally important. Which is why when it comes to ritual impurity shares this indivisibility as well. When you touch with your pinky finger a corpse, what becomes impure? When you touch a corpse with your pinky finger, a person touches a corpse, what becomes impure?
Well, your body.
Their whole body, not just the pinky. Right? When you touch impurity, it's the whole thing. And likewise, if you touch the edge of the source of impurity, you also become in totality impure. In other words, it's indivisible. Same thing is true with a mitzvah. You touch one mitzvah, you're touching the core. You do a small mitzvah. You say, it's a small mitzvah. It's not a big mitzvah. What did I do already? A small mitzvah, there's no such thing as a small mitzvah. Every mitzvah is part of this indivisible core desire of God. And therefore, number one, no one is greater than another, less than another. And number two, each one touches on God's essential will. And so what's the takeaway? The takeaway is that as we look for connection in our lives, we should remember that every mitzvah opportunity is absolute gold. We should never say, this mitzvah, it's not worth my time. This mitzvah, not so important. Or this mitzvah, way more important than that mitzvah. That's not a chukas, that's not a chukim message. A chukim message for this week, a paradum, a red heifer message is every mitzvah is absolutely precious and invaluable. You know, the Rebbe said that before the Six-Day War, it's the 50th anniversary and you know all that stuff of the Six-Day War and of the mitzvah camp, the tefillin campaign, put on tefillin. He said to anybody who would listen, go into Manhattan, hit the streets, and ask people, are you Jewish? Good, let's wrap tefillin. And people said, what's the point? Waste of time. So they'll put on tefillin once. Who cares? They didn't put it on yesterday, and they may not put it on tomorrow. So what does it matter if they put on tefillin today? What does it matter? Look at the laws from the negative. Look at the laws of impurity. When you touch, even with a pinky, the edge of something, it makes a full connection. The same thing is true with every mitzvah. Every mitzvah represents, even if it's a small thing, a two-minute thing, it doesn't matter. Every mitzvah represents God's full and essential will and desire. And therefore, every mitzvah that we do connects us, and this is the final point, mitzvah means connection, connects us with Hashem, connects us with God. So, 2 points. Number one, suspending logic. To do a mitzvah is healthy. To be stuck in our heads, unhealthy. Suspension of self, of ego, of rationale can be very, very healthy for a person, number one. And number two, every mitzvah connects with God perfectly and essentially. So, next time we have a mitzvah, let's take the opportunity and, like Nike says, just do it. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.